Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. We kick off the show as we do this year with weird laws from around the world. Today's law comes courtesy of North Korea. No surprises here, but in North Korea, only government-approved haircuts are allowed. There are 18 predetermined hairstyles for women and 10 predetermined hairstyles for men, and you can only choose from those. No surprises there. I suppose it would be difficult to build a business on that side if you offered creative haircuts because they're simply not allowed. You're tuning into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we take a look at the latest developments in the Gautrain conundrum that they find themselves in. They've had to suspend some of their services owing to some illegal digging and mining that's taken place in the Johannesburg area. We're going to speak to the Gautrain Management Agency themselves to get an understanding of the impact this is having on their business. You would have heard a little earlier on, Ashraf spoke to the government around that from a government perspective around some of the policies and guidelines that are in place for this sort of digging that takes place. We're going to get a sense from the Gautrain's perspective around what this means for their business. We're also going to take a look at the performance from Amplats. They announced a special dividend and a confirmation of that unbundling that we'd been discussing for quite some time. We are expecting some updates from that. We're going to look at that and see where we stand with that business. And we're going to have a look at some of the M&A activity that took place in 2024. We're going to speak to the team at Herbert Smith Freehills around the M&A report that they put together that suggests that South Africa is still very much the most attractive destination for M&A activity in 2024. Then we've got our usual tech feature with Nafisa Akabor. She's going to take us through EVs this week and what she's been going through in her experiences. And then we're going to wrap things up with a personal finance segment. We're going to be speaking about tax-free savings accounts, and we're going to be checking in on how to make the most of that in this tax period as we approach the end of the tax year for many people.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We get the ball rolling with a markets update and sense of how the markets have been performing throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by portfolio manager and director at Rand Swiss, Gary Boyson, to take a look at some of the movements. Good evening, Gary. Lovely to catch up with you as always. It was a quiet day for some markets, and we thought we might get a bit of activity in the afternoon, but with US session or US markets being closed for the day as well, that didn't seem to be the case. How did you process the day's movements?
Yeah, it was a much quieter day than usual. As you say, the US is going to be closed or is closed at the moment for that President's Day public holiday. So no action from the US, which does subdue international markets as well. Although Europe did have a fairly strong session. We had the DAX up well over 1%. FTSE and the CAC in Paris also up marginally. The South African index, however, did fall. So we were down around a third of 1%. And that was really led lower by the resource counters. Now, if you have a look at it, I suppose that the big falls came from the likes of AngloGold and Goldfields, both down around 4.5%. Harmony also falling around 3.5%. But you get the sense that maybe there's a little bit of concern about the resource index overall. Of course, we've got Marco Rubio, the U.S. Secretary of State, meeting with his counterpart from Russia in Saudi Arabia to discuss the end of the Ukraine war. And I'm sure many listeners will remember when the Ukraine war broke out, the disruption that it caused to global trade and the spike that we saw in commodity prices. So if we do see an easing in that conflict and some more commodities coming through, you could see a significant downward pressure on commodity prices, although a lot of that was coming from the gold miners. Some of the platinum miners also down today, the likes of Northam down around 1.75%. But yeah, very, very quiet overall. Rand still strangely range-bound. So for most of February, we've been trading a very, very narrow range in what is a very volatile unit. So we've got the rand-dollar exchange rate sitting at around 1873 at the moment. Dollar index is still weakening, so maybe some of that exuberance of America First policies coming out of the U.S. and that huge run-up we saw in the dollar to around 110 on the dollar index just starting to unwind as everyone gets a little bit more concerned about what these tariffs are actually going to do to the underlying market.
You touched on the rand, Gary, and I mean, I'm looking at the performance of the rand. As you said, range bound, not really doing much there. We've got our budget speech coming up this week. I want to get your thoughts around some expectations that you might be looking forward to and perhaps how the local markets might be faring. We typically see around this time that the rand and our local markets kind of stay a bit muted, waiting to see what pronouncements are made in the budget speech. What are you thinking will happen this time around?
Well, I think it's going to be a very interesting budget speech. So definitely looking forward to it on Wednesday. And I think from a market point of view, I think a lot of negativity is still priced into South African markets. And we don't need to have, stellar, amazing market-friendly announcements from our finance minister. They just don't have to be terrible. And I think you could potentially see the rand appreciating a little bit, and you might see our indices doing fairly well following the budget speech. I think the big challenges at the moment is, of course, we're still going to be running a budget deficit. Our debt to GDP, I don't think we're going to see too many changes in the fiscal projections from the medium-term budget policy statement. And we're still significantly above where you would expect an emerging market economy to be sitting. So, I mean, we've got projections around 75% debt to GDP. As an emerging market, really, the safe level is around 60%. So we're well above that. And it's one of the reasons that we've seen the credit ratings agencies downgrade us to junk rating. And until we can get that under control, I don't see us moving back to investment grade. If we do move back to investment grade, though, then all sorts of wonderful things start to happen. The cost of our borrowing recedes. We can potentially have lower interest rates. There's a lot of benefit to getting our investment grade back. Now, I think the key challenge that we're going to see is how do we afford this deficit? Are we going to borrow more, which we don't really want to, or are we going to come to the taxpayer and look to raise more tax revenue? And that's also very, very difficult. At the moment, you've got what's called the Laffer curve. So that essentially is how you optimize tax revenue. If you obviously don't tax anything, you get no revenue. If you tax at 100%, you don't get any revenue either because everyone stops working because no one will pay tax. No one's going to pay 100% tax. And it's kind of this curve that you look at to try and optimize what is the maximum tax that you can extract from an economy as a government. And we're right at kind of the pinnacle of the Laffer curve. So it's, increasing taxes in South Africa could actually result in lower revenue for the fiscus, which is always going to be dangerous. So how do we fund this? I mean, guys have floated the idea of a potentially another VAT increase. I don't see that happening. Obviously it hits the poor very, very hard. It's also, politically, I think, untenable. And if anything, there's been a lot of talk around, adding more zero-rated items to the VAT basket as well. So almost moving in the opposite direction on VAT. So I can't see that. I think the idea of bracket creep will definitely be used. I don't think we're going to see the income tax brackets moving significantly to account for inflation. And that, I suppose, help to generate additional revenue. I mean, there's also been ideas of a wealth tax, but that's also very difficult to implement practically because obviously it's not really a clever idea because capital is incredibly mobile. And if you do increase or institute a general wealth tax, you'll see capital fly from South Africa very quickly. So, I think it's going to be a very difficult budget to present. And I think it's going to be an interesting one. We're definitely going to watch it with bated breath. Hopefully, we don't see any reduction in NPA funding. I think, increasing the efficiency of how we spend our tax revenue is probably something that the market could really latch onto. If there are concrete steps to improve the deployment of our taxpayer money, I think that would be very, very positive. But yeah, really looking forward to understanding how we're going to contain our debt and allocate the budget.
Well, I don't know if we're containing our debt if we're applying to the World Bank for an additional 27 billion rand, but that we'll have to see if we get approved for that. I suppose they're still waiting for our FICA documents and waiting to see what we do with that. Gary, before I let you go, I want to take a look at some other data that's coming out this week. Inflation and unemployment data from South Africa coming out this week. We kind of have been expecting unemployment to not change much. Inflation might be a bit of an important number for our central bank to just get a bit of a bearing around what's happening there and how quickly or not, whether or not they still have that under control. What are your thoughts around those numbers that are coming out and what are your expectations there?
Yeah, so unemployment, I tend to agree. So unemployment will be out tomorrow morning. You know, previously 32.1%, you know, on the headline rate. I also don't see major movements there. You know, a lot of our unemployment problems are structural, and it's difficult to see how that number moves down without creating significant growth in the economy, which I don't think that we've managed to achieve. You know, the inflation, as you say, also very, very interesting. You know, we obviously have an inflation targeting framework at the moment. You know, keep inflation between 3 and 6%. The previous print was at 3%. So, you know, looking at most of the forecasts and where we see consensus at the moment, you know, we think inflation is going to be fairly subdued. I don't think we're going to see it creeping up. You know, it might creep up a little bit. I mean, call it maybe 3.1, 3.2 at a headline level. Although oil prices have been behaved, the currency's been behaved. So yeah, I think you know, kind of in line with what we saw last time, lower end of the overall bracket will be probably a reasonable expectation. Of course, that headline number does include energy and food, at least, which are both very volatile numbers. So you could still potentially get some surprises. If you look at the core rate, though, we're sitting at 3.6. Our inflation is still very much contained. I suppose one other number that we're going to get out is the South African retail sales on Wednesday, along with those inflation numbers. And I think that one's going to be interesting as well. We saw, you know, a big jump up in retail sales last time, you know, just because of obviously Black Friday sales, etc. This is going to be the December figure now. And if you remember, Black Friday actually fell. We had that Cyber Monday on in December. So I think it's going to skew the number a little bit. And most forecasts are for fairly weak retail sales over the December period. And I think we might get a little bit of a surprise in the retail sales numbers just because of the timing around the Cyber Monday deals. But let's see. Yeah, lots of inflation data. But of course, the big one this week is almost certainly going to be that budget. So looking forward to it.
Yeah, I don't think we'll get anything other than budget conversations between now and Thursday, but we'll keep an eye on those data points as they come out and possibly see if they line up with what we'll hear on Wednesday. We'll leave the conversation there, Gary. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Gary Boysen, Director and Portfolio Manager at Rand Swiss, joining us to take a look at the market movements throughout the day as well as what could potentially be driving the markets throughout the rest of the week.
Time. When you're a kid, it moves slower than a sloth trying to get through airport security. There is just so much of it. Skip forward a few years to your 20s. Time is still your friend. It says have some balance. Go party and have fun. Then your 30s hit. And time suddenly steps on the accelerator like it's trying to catch a traffic light before it goes red. 40s. Now time is moving faster than your 10-year-old on a sugar high. 50. You're desperately trying to save as much as you can, but time is moving so fast. And all you can think is, where did all the time go? That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time for some much-deserved you time. Now, isn't that a compelling enough reason to invest? Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And you would have heard a little earlier on Ashraf speaking to the Johannesburg Council around the developments happening or developments affecting the Gautrain from an operational standpoint between Park Station and Rosebank. We're going to be taking a look at that, but we're going to be taking a look at it from a slightly different perspective, from a business perspective. We're going to be speaking to the Gautrain Management Agency themselves and joined on the line by the Gautrain Management Agency's CEO, Tsepo Gobe, to take a look at this. Good evening, Tsepo. Thanks so much for taking the time. Obviously, these were unexpected disruptions that the business would rather avoid, but what's happening at the moment? What's the latest from your side?
Good evening, Jimmy, and thank you for having me. So over the last 2 days, we've actually just inspected the hold, so also understood what the challenge was, and also found where the property is, where they had drilled the borehole from. but also inspected the slab to check that the structural integrity is still in place for the tunnel, so we don't have, we're not going to have a sudden collapse of the tunnel because of what has been done. And then just generally cleaning out the muck, sort of the water and all the vehicle and sand that has flown into the tunnel. It has slowed down overall, so which then allows us to be able to can be able to go back and do further inspections. And then come up with a solution. We have come up with a solution to stop the water immediately, which then allows us to be able to think through the permanent repairs of the hole and then the permanent backfill of the borehole itself at the top. And that has been, I've just come out of a meeting with Auto Decolor, with the engineers now. It looks like we're getting somewhere with Auto Decolor with the final assessment of the damage and then and also the solution stack and in what sequence do we actually go ahead and Auto Decolor and start the repairs. And we're hoping probably by the end of the week we'll be able to sort out the problem.
Tsepo, if I remember correctly, when we had the Gautrain construction happening, there was a lot of imported equipment from Germany to dig the tunnels and all of that. It was a very, very expensive exercise many, many years ago. The repairs themselves, I'd imagine, are not going to be in that range. I imagine there's some sort of plan that you, as you said, you're sitting with engineers to work through to make sure you guys are prepared for it. But we're not looking at things like having to import things in, or is it too early to tell at this point, I suppose?
Look, I wouldn't say no to certain things. I mean, particular scans that we use for what do they call for scanning tunnel lining. It's not something that you have lying around everywhere. So it's that sort of a thing that is creating the sort of the slowness in the finalizing the implementation of the solution stack in itself. So we are trying to find. So there is guys who are working on the tunnels that are bringing water from the from Lesotho, and they were doing some repairs on the outfall there, the concrete on the outfall. So we are hoping that some of that is still in the country as they had brought it in. There's also the work that we've done when I used to be in mining, and I'm clear that, you know, in some of the work that we did there, there are scans that are available. They are not going to be cheap to do the scans and all of that, but there is scans available and capability available in the country.
Tsepo, what about the financial disruptions? I mean, the financial impact on your business as well. Obviously, you have been able to make alternative arrangements, but those alternative arrangements are a cost to the business to be able to run those buses between the two affected stations, but also the lost revenue for those trips where you can now no longer go all the way through to Park Station. How's the financial side of it affecting the business? And is it something you've been able to even start to think about? I mean, it's still fairly soon to tell the full extent of the financial impact, but I'm guessing you want to avoid as little disruption as possible.
You're right, Jimmy. I think the and that is why, like, we're meeting every afternoon to make sure that we expedite the solution. The longer we run the buses, there's the emissions on the other side. You know, we pride ourselves as being able to remove vehicles off the road. And now when we are adding more vehicles on the road, it's a big issue. Then there's the issue of the diesel we're burning, running buses up and down. You are creating long-term maintenance challenges because you're running them for more kilometers than you had planned to have run them, because you're doing more trips and all of that. And then there's then the general lost opportunity of somebody who's done it suddenly says, well, I go on a pay-as-you-go basis, and therefore, if I'm not going to go all the way to Park on the train, I'm not going to take the service at all. So there's also people who have stayed away because of that, the general disruption of not being able to go all the way. So there's also the money that you're losing generally from people who would not come through because their feeling is that the product that I had bought into is the one that takes me all the way to Park, and I only take the bus once. Whereas this is now, you take a bus to Park, and then at Park, then you get the buses that distribute you into the city.
So before I let you go, I want to look at one final cost, and that's the cost of repairing all of this. Does that sit with you? Does that sit with those that created the problem? I imagine you'd have a legal consult around this with your teams to see what's the most efficient way to recover the cost and who's at fault here. But is it something that you are even considering exploring to say, you know what, we didn't cause the problem, so why should we have to bear all of the burden?
No, the law is clear about that. I mean, Section 53, I think, of the GTIA Act, the Housing Transport Infrastructure Act, talks to the offences and how to deal with the offences. And also Section 52 talks to the prohibitions, and that would have been the legal instrument on which this gets authorised or not get authorised. And therefore, the legal opinion I've received now is that whatever we spend here, we will have to recover from the person that created the damage.
I sure hope someone has their insurance sorted out. We'll leave the conversation there, Tsepo. Well, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Hopefully you guys get this sorted and get the trains back on a track as soon as possible. Tsepo Hobe, who is the CEO of the Gautrain Management Agency, joining us to take a look at their disruptions and how they're dealing with it.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Anglo-American Platinum decided to surprise the markets with a more than 50 Rand special dividend to shareholders as part of a decision to move ahead with the unbundling from the Anglo-American group. That is the definition of a special dividend, more than 50 Rand a share. Our editor at MoneyWeb caught up with the CEO of Amplats a little earlier on, Craig Miller, to take a look at this and some of the other developments within the business. Let's listen in on how that conversation went.
Anglo American Platinum is the largest single producer of platinum group metals in the world. It employs more than 30,000 employees and it operates 5 mines in the Bushveld complex and 1 in Zimbabwe. Anglo American currently owns about 67% of the company and is in the process of demerging its interest. And this process is well on its way, and Anglo's announced today that it will retain around 20% of the business. Amplat today also announced financial results. It was for the 2024 financial year, and the big announcement was that the company will return 16.5 billion rand to shareholders in the form of a normal and special dividend, and it amounts to 62 rand a share. Craig Miller is on the line. He's the chief executive. Craig, thank you so much for your time. Let's start with this dividend. It's a significant amount. What is the thinking of paying such a massive special dividend shortly before a demerger?
Yes, so as you've pointed out, we are in the process of demerging from the Anglo-American Group. And part of that demerger process is really setting ourselves up for a sustainable long-term future as an independent PGM producer. And one of the work streams, in addition to many others, in terms of preparing for that standalone company, is an opportunity for us to relook at our balance sheet. And part of that work that we've done on the balance sheet is during the last 12 months, we've worked hard to reset the business to make it fit for purpose and sustainable into the future. And we finished the year with about 18 billion rand on our balance sheet. And then, as I said, in terms of anticipating the demerger in the middle of the year, we've taken this opportunity to reset that and look to distribute 16.5 billion rand to shareholders and to all shareholders in the coming months. And effectively what that is a 3 rand per share ordinary dividend, which is based on 40% of our earnings, and a 59 rand special dividend or additional cash dividend to shareholders, which we will also pay out. And then that sort of really then puts us on a pro forma basis to be in a cash neutral position. And therefore, we look forward to the future being able to continue to drive value from the world-class asset base that we have in the PGM space.
But if you have 18 billion rand cash in the bank and you give 16.5 billion to shareholders, including 11 billion to parent company Anglo-American, that will leave your balance sheet in a significantly worse position than it would have been if you didn't pay this dividend. So, you know, what's the reasoning? Is it just extracting value from Anglo-American side?
Look, as I said, going through the demerger process, it's quite typical for companies to have a look at their balance sheet on demerger. And this has been our opportunity to reset that balance sheet. And as a consequence of that, that's the dividend that we've declared today. I think, you know, from our perspective, Rake, I mean, we look forward. All of our assets are generating cash, even at the current PGM levels. And when we look forward, we're confident that we'll be able to continue to invest in the business, really extracting value from the likes of our Mogalakwena asset, continuing to extract value from our downstream processing assets. And when we look forward and we look at other companies which are standalone entities, they do have a level of debt on their balance sheet. And we're comfortable that we'll be able to trade at below 1x net debt to EBITDA through the commodity price cycle.
What would the strategy be post this demerger? Because a nice cash balance would have opened up opportunities for acquisitions. And now what you're saying is maybe it will be more an economic growth strategy.
Certainly. I mean, I think for us, when we've worked on our strategy as that independent company, a key focus for us is really investing back into the portfolio of assets that we have. You know, we have some of the best PGM assets in the industry. And you just look at our Mogalakwena mine, which is an 80-year mine. We certainly believe that there is plenty of value that we can extract from that. And that's where our focus will be. We're a PGM producer. We do that well. We can do that better and extract more value. And that's where our focus is. And we believe that we've got the requisite capital and funding to be able to support that strategy without necessarily going out and doing M&A and purchasing assets that we've previously held in the portfolio.
Post the demerger, who will be the largest shareholder in Anglo American Platinum?
So based on the announcement that we made today, I anticipate that Anglo American will still retain a 19.9% stake. So that will probably be one of the higher stakes that we have. But I imagine that they will look to reduce their stake in due course. That's quite typical of what you see when parent companies demerge their subsidiaries. And then we'll have a plethora of other shareholders based both here in South Africa and shareholders in Europe, in the UK, and in North America as well.
And the timeline for this corporate action or transaction or demerger, as you call it, when will everything be done and you have listed offshore and it's a standalone company?
We're working incredibly hard to try to complete the demerger by the middle of this year. What it does require is that we're preparing for that through the secondary listing on the London Stock Exchange. So we'll still retain our primary listing here in Johannesburg on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, but also preparing for the secondary listing on the London Stock Exchange. We're also Anglo American. We'll seek its shareholders' approval at its AGM at the end of April to support the demerger. And once that approval has come through, then really it's all systems go to complete the demerger by the middle of the year.
Just lastly, will Amplats change its name?
Yes, that's more than likely to be the case. As part of the demerger, we will no longer retain the name Anglo American. So we're actively working on a new name for our business and really looking forward to the opportunity of being that standalone company and really creating value for all of our stakeholders, both here in South Africa and other parts of the world.
Now, renaming a company is always an interesting exercise. But Craig, thank you so much for your time and good luck for the next few months. I'm sure you will have many late nights.
Thank you, Rick. Thanks very much. But I really am looking forward to the middle of the year.
That was Craig Miller, the Chief Executive of Anglo American Platinum.
Affordable data is more than just a convenience. It's a real catalyst for change. In the latest Fix SA episode, I talked to George Mendez, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Cell C, about the telco industry's role in driving inclusive economic growth. From empowering underserved communities to fostering entrepreneurship, connectivity is unlocking potential and creating opportunities.
Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
Certainly a very interesting decision there from Amplats to pay out that special dividend. We'll keep an eye on that and see what that balance sheet does look like indeed after the demerger has taken place. We're going to move on to some interesting information or more interesting news around mergers, particularly mergers and acquisitions activity that took place in 2024. We're going to be chatting to Mondi Kotto, who is the director at Herbert Smith Freehills. He joins me now to take a look at the latest M&A activity report that they've put together for the year 2024. Mondi, good evening. Thanks so much for taking the time. The report is quite an interesting report. It suggests that more than 60% of the continental M&A activity still sits in South Africa. So obviously, South Africa is still very much an attractive investment destination or attractive transacting destination.
Good evening, Jimmy, and thank you for having me, and good evening to your listeners. Yes, as you said, Jimmy, we put together a report annually at Herbert Smith Freehills, and this one in particular focused on activity in Africa this past year. And that is correct. A large portion of the deal value across the continent, 60% was in South Africa, and 30% from a deal volume perspective was also in South Africa. So it continues to be a great destination for investors, and there were a large few big ticket items as well, which helped push up the deal value in South Africa. And that will be public deals, which we've heard quite a bit about these large public takeovers and proposed deals in our market, such as that spin-off of Anglo, which was being discussed a short while ago, as well as deals like the proposed takeover of MultiChoice by Canal Plus. So those deals are pushing up deal value. And yeah, those are green shoots when we look at the market over the past few years. We've seen that deal values and deal volumes have been decreasing. So it's been really positive to see that across the continent and globally, that in 2024, there's an increase in deal value. And that all came down to these public deals really pushing the market up.
Mondi, what about the rest of the continent? What are some of the other markets or some of the other regions that are doing well? I know Nigeria is likely to be in the top two, maybe even the top three there. What's the rest of the continent looking like from a deal activity point of view?
So the rest of the continent is doing well. We're seeing a lot of activity in Nigeria, as you mentioned. Kenya is also picking up, and there's quite a lot of deal activity in Northern Africa as well. So South Africa was first from a deal activity perspective. Nigeria in 2024 was second from a deal value perspective. I think they accounted for about 15% of deal value. And from a deal volume perspective, Nigeria was about 8% of the continent's activity. And then Egypt was third from a deal value perspective, and they accounted for around 8% of deal value and 25% from deal volumes. So I think those were the three key areas across the continent this year, or three key countries.
Mondi, did you identify certain key types of transactions? Was there a pattern in terms of the kinds of, or maybe even the sectors that the transactions are taking place in, the kinds of activity that's happening here? I know markets like South Africa, markets like Nigeria, for those markets, fintech is a big thing. But as you mentioned earlier, mining is taking quite a bit of interest in terms of what investors might be looking at. Is there something that we can see, or is it just kind of spread out across whatever is a good value asset?
No, 100%. There were key sectors, Jimmy. And as you mentioned, financial services, and that's where fintech would fall in. Because in South Africa, we do have a very advanced and sophisticated financial services market. We saw that a lot of activity came through in financial services. I think from a sector perspective, that was probably the second sector where we saw the largest amount of activity. There was also a lot of activity in consumer. And I think the third category across the continent in which we saw activity in was mining. And there, as we've seen, there's been a lot of demergers, unbundling of assets. And of course, that creates opportunities for others to acquire those assets.
When we think about M&A activity, a lot of it comes down to kind of companies or things that have already been built, that have been running. Those deals typically, like the Anglo deal, are the bigger deals. But there's also been a kind of a focus towards things like venture capital and starting up new businesses. I know the likes of Silicon Valley do that quite often. South Africa and Africa in general have been trying to kind of pick up the pace around the VC space. What's happened in the last year? Because that seems to have also kind of gone quiet. Is that still a big focal point? Is it still something where there's a lot of deal activity that's taking place?
I think that's a very good observation there, Jimmy, that it has been a bit quiet. And also just having, in the past months, I've been speaking to quite a few players in the VC space. And a few have said things have slowed down quite a bit. I think deals are taking a lot longer in VC. Traditionally, VC is where you get very quick and dynamic deals. The deal time and deal timetables are usually very short. But with all the uncertainty and difficulties in the global and macro picture, we have seen deals take longer to close, just because we're seeing that buyers or investors are trying to gain a lot more certainty or de-risk these deals through enhanced due diligence, and trying to direct terms a lot more to close the gap to make sure they're not overpaying. But from an activity point of view, unfortunately, when it comes to the VC space, we've seen a decrease in both deal value and deal volume, whereas in the broader M&A perspective, we've seen a decrease in deal volumes, but we've seen an increase in deal values because of these big public deals we've been talking about. In VC, unfortunately, that's not the case. We've seen decreases in volumes and values, but there still have been some really positive stories in VC. And if we bring it closer to home, last year we saw the birth of a unicorn in South Africa. That was Time Bank, which achieved unicorn status in its Series D round last year. So there still have been some very meaningful deals happening in the VC space, but things have slowed down a bit more. And hopefully in this year, we'll see a bit more of an uptick in VC again. And a lot of that dry powder, which has been sitting on the sidelines, hopefully coming into play.
Monday, before I let you go, I want to take a look at how Africa is stacking up against the other regions around the world. Obviously, the likes of Europe, Asia, still very big on these sorts of transactions. LATAM, Latin America, also gaining a lot of interest. How are you seeing Africa stacking up against the rest of the world?
I would say it's actually, I think the trends globally have been pretty consistent. So I think the trends we're seeing globally, we're also seeing those play out closer to home in Africa. For example, if we look at deal volumes, globally deal volumes decreased by 23%. In Africa, we saw a decrease of 10%. So from that perspective, Africa was faring well from a global perspective. And when it came to a deal volumes perspective, we also saw Africa faring well there, whereas they only went up by 9%. Globally, we did see up to a 74% or 85% increase in Africa. So I think Africa has been doing well from a global perspective. But on a more broader level, I think the trends are similar in Africa and across the continent and globally.
Mondi, what does this look like for 2025? We have quite a big year ahead of us. There's been, I've lost count of how many executive orders we've gotten from the United States. But what does the landscape look like from a conversation perspective and probably from a deal structuring perspective? Are we more optimistic going into this year that more deals might be on the table? Or is it still one of those find the right deals and we can increase the values of the deals and maybe not as many transactions, but higher value transactions like we did last year?
Yeah, Jimmy, definitely when you speak about those executive orders, I think each morning we're waking up not sure what will happen today. So there is that macro uncertainty which continues to be in play, and we need to continue to monitor that and see how it impacts deals. If we look at the green shoots from this past year, which was that large increase in deal value, even though deal volumes remain low, I think it is promising and hopeful that there might be a build-up in activity in 2025. And what we are seeing in the market is that there still is an appetite to do deals. And what we're seeing from a deal maker's perspective is that deal makers are becoming more innovative in their approach to deal making, and they're trying to find solutions, whether it be enhancing their due diligence or whether it's re-looking at terms and trying to make those buyer friendly and cater for the risks and uncertainty in the market. We're seeing that there is an appetite to do deals, but they might just take a bit more work in that we need to make sure that the terms cater for all the risk and uncertainty in the market.
The deals are certainly there. They might just need a little bit more work to iron out, but we'll have to keep an eye out on these and see how they shape up. Thanks so much for those insights, Mondi. Thanks for the contributions as well. Mondi Kotto, who is a director at Herbert Smith Freehills, joining us to take a look at their latest M&A activity report for 2024 that suggests that deal value increased on the African continent, even though there were less deals in play.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's that time on a Monday where we take a look at our tech features. This week we are doing a bit of a dive into the world of EVs in South Africa. We're trying to see what the most affordable, least expensive EVs look like in South Africa and get a bit of an understanding around that. As usual, we're joined by our resident tech specialist, tech journalist and EV specialist. She's also the founder of recharged.co.za. That is Nafisa Akabor. Good evening, Nafisa. Lovely to catch up with you as always. You recently had an EV over the weekend to test drive. How was that? How was the EV experience?
Hi, Jimmy. So I was driving the Dayun S5 Mini SUV. It is regarded as one of the cheapest, but by cheapest, I mean least expensive EVs in South Africa at 400,000 Rand. It was quite an interesting experience because being punted as this least expensive or cheapest, you get up to 300 kilometers of range. Well, that's what I got on my full charge. But it has a 31.7 kilowatt hour battery, which is a bit small given the range. And then the motor is 35 kilowatts, not to get too technical, but it is a, what I would call an underpowered car compared to, let's say, the Mini EV that I'm currently have on a long-term test. So it was a very interesting experience. The way I drove it on the highway, it was like people behind me were flashing me for driving too slow, which I found quite amusing because of the slow power. But obviously, I'm driving efficiently and economically. And then when I drove, I think it's more suited for city driving, urban roads, like traffic situations. So that was something that caught my eye. I've never thought, we all know EVs are most efficiently on a highway. And yes, it is true. But given the power of this car, you might just be a bit too slow for the drivers behind you.
Nafisa, what about the other EVs kind of out there at the moment? You said that this was the least expensive of some of the ones that are out there in South Africa. Where are we in terms of the EV range that have made it into South Africa? Which ones seem to be more popular? I mean, I think back to many, many years ago when the Toyota Prius was first launched. I think that was the first EV we got in South Africa. Since then, the likes of the Nissan Leaf have come into the market and that sort of thing. How does the landscape look now?
Just a quick correction. The Prius was a hybrid, but the landscape right now, one of the newer models that launched last year, the Volvo EX30, it's a very small compact car starting at just late 700s, early 800,000s. That was actually the best seller for 2024. It sold 406 units, which is quite substantial if you think that there were only 1,257 EVs sold in South Africa for 2024. But there are cheaper EVs than that, like the BYD Dolphin comes in about 540,000, and then the GWM Aura comes in at 686,000. And then obviously the Mini comes just above that. So there are a few options under R1 million, but all very expensive for vehicles.
Nafisa, what about importing some of the models? What about models that might not have arrived in South Africa yet, that might be retailing at slightly more affordable prices outside South Africa? Is that even worth it? Is the EV market big enough in South Africa? I mean, 1,200 odd cars a year doesn't seem like a big enough market to really move a lot of manufacturing here and to move a lot of the infrastructure here, does it?
It sounds like a small number, but if you look at it with the previous numbers, for example, in 2022, it was 502 units. So we've now doubled 2 years later. So I don't use the term exponentially, obviously, all the time, but our growth is exponential if you consider globally what is happening. And we're not at the same pace. We're growing at a different pace than the global market because they already had a head start and they're stagnating a bit, but we are taking off now because we are a bit behind. But there are loads of other cheaper runaround EVs that you'll find in Europe and China. We would never get them because by the time EVs get to South Africa with the 25% import duties, and then there's other taxes that kind of make it 45% in total more expensive, it's not going to be worth it for any of those manufacturers to bring those cheaper cars into SA, unfortunately.
Mm. Nafisa, what about the infrastructure? Has the infrastructure caught up? I'm thinking about things like charging stations and everything that comes with transitioning from internal combustion engines to EVs. Are we kind of seeing exponential growth on that side?
I wouldn't say exponential as such, but I think we made great progress. We have just under 400 EV chargers across the country, whether it's AC or DC, and they're like kind of strategically located at the highways, the fast chargers, and then you'll find them at car dealerships, shopping malls and hotels and office parks. But what some manufacturers are able to do, the slightly higher end ones with the more expensive vehicles, they actually throw in a free wall box charger for your home or whichever location you want to put it actually. So the idea behind that is you don't have to rely on a public charger. And yes, everyone says you need it, but if you are a EV owner, it works in your benefit to have the EV charger at home, so you're less reliant on it. So I think just relying on public EV chargers is not completely accurate, because the best way to experience it properly is to have your own charger at home so you don't rely on the public ones. But obviously, it is needed.
Nafisa, what next for the EV market? I mean, obviously with the increase in demand slowly starting to pick up the pace, we're going to see greater adoption going forward, hopefully, I suppose. What next for what becomes attractive in the space? Is it now you understanding that we've solved our electricity problems, this market does become a more viable solution? Is it the production and bringing some of the production in onshore? I know some of the Chinese companies have shown interest in wanting to bring manufacturing here, but not necessarily limited to EVs.
There is still one big limitation, and that's for the prices to come down and for government to incentivize us as customers or consumers to buy these cars. We're like one of the only countries in the world who's being penalized for buying EVs, while the rest of the world, they're getting incentives by the government. So the price needs to come down, and that will definitely increase the adoption. It's great that the manufacturers have their own incentives for electric and hydrogen-powered vehicles. That's going to kick in next year in March 2026, but work still has to be done on the consumer side.
There's a lot of work to be done, but there is progress being made. EVs are starting to become even more popular. We'll keep an eye on this and see if we get to even bigger numbers when we reflect on it possibly next year. But thanks so much for the insights, Nafisa. Always lovely catching up with you. Nafisa Akabor, who is a tech and EV journalist, joining us to take a look at the growing trend of EVs and what affordable EVs might be out there in the market.
The Property Pod.
South Africa's new Expropriation Act hit the international headlines last week after US President Donald Trump launched a broadside on the issue. On the latest episode of The Property Pod on MoneyWeb, we look at the Expropriation Act from the side of the residential property sector. Samuel Seif, chairperson of Seif Property Group, weighs in on why he is not too worried about the act impacting the industry.
The Property Pod.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's personal finance time on a Monday, and given that it is the budget week and it is also almost the end of the financial year for some, being the 28th of Feb, about 10 or 11 days away there, I thought we'd take a look at how you can make the most of some of those tax decisions you have to make between now and next week, in particular looking at something like the tax-free savings account. It's been a very big, very useful tool for South Africans since it's been introduced, and we're going to take a look at how to maximize on that, especially in this particular time of the year. I'm joined on the line by the co-founder at Fynbos Money, Adrian Hope Bailey, to take a look at this. Good evening, Adrian. Thanks so much for taking the time. The tax-free savings account is something that was introduced a couple of years ago as part of an effort for South Africans to be able to maximize on some of their tax benefits. Yet somehow, still, many South Africans don't utilize this. They aren't taking advantage of this. Why is that?
Hi, Jimmy. Thanks very much for having me on the show. We don't know for sure. We have a few theories at Fynbos Money, but we think probably the two prevailing reasons are, one, they're not very lucrative as a generator of fees through AUM because of the contribution limits. So if you're, you know, advising people where to put their money and you make your fees through AUM-based or percentage-based fees, you're not going to make a lot out of telling people to put it in a tax-free savings account, because there is that 36,000 Rand a year limit and 500,000 Rand lifetime limit. The other, I think, is that the space has been dominated by the banks. Somehow, something that was called a tax-free investment in the legislation ended up being labeled the tax-free savings account, and that name seems to have stuck, even though tax-free investments or tax-free savers are really a long-term investment vehicle. They're way more useful to you if you leave your money in there for decades rather than, you know, short horizons like 5-10 years. And so they shouldn't really be used for savings at all. They should be for long-term investments. So I think it's just a combination of misunderstanding the benefit and bad marketing.
Mm. You mentioned the fact that they should be used for long-term investments. From a tax-free savings perspective, are you precluded from investing in anything in particular? I mean, the accounts are there. It's almost under a tax wrapper of sorts, but are you kind of prevented from deploying that capital into certain things, or is it just a free-for-all up to that limit?
There are some limitations. So you're not going to find a tax-free savings account that allows you to invest in directly into, you know, single company shares as an example. But it's much less limited than, for example, your pensions and your RAs. So as an example, you can have a tax-free savings account that is all offshore equities.
So you could put everything into a nice long-term vehicle like a MSCI World, index tracking feeder fund, and you can leave it there for 40 years, and you're getting great, international exposure, diversity, low fees, all of that, versus, let's say a pension or an RA where you would have, quite a strict limit on what can go offshore.
Adrian, what about the contributions towards the tax-free savings? You touched on it earlier to say that there's maximum contributions and also lifetime contributions, and we are coming up to the end of that financial year. How important is it to make use of the contributions now and not wait until, say, later in the year when you say, oh, perhaps I can roll the benefit into the new year, because that's not a possibility?
Absolutely, and I think that's key. The two different limits on the tax-free savings account are really what should drive how you use them. So you've got your annual limit of 36K and you've got a lifetime limit of 500,000. And what that means is it's going to take you at least 14 years to hit your lifetime limit if you utilize your full annual limit every year. So that's quite a long time. And a lot of people will look at that and say, well, it's a lot of money. But the reality is if you sit around and wait for a windfall, you wait for a big bonus, or, you wait for an inheritance or something to invest, you can end up with, a big lump sum. And now you can't put all of it into that tax-free, and you're going to have to spread it out over a few years, and you're going to lose out on that benefit because, as we all know, that the real benefit in long-term investing is time. The longer you can leave that money invested, the more you're going to benefit from the compounding in the long term. And that really is what the tax-free is all about. It's about the gains. It's about, not paying tax on all of that gain that you've got on your investment in 20, 30, even 40 years' time, where the majority of your investment after such a long horizon is all gains. It's all growth. And that's where normally you would be paying a big chunk of that to the tax man. If it's in a tax-free saver, every cent is yours.
Adrian, what are some of the other misconceptions that are out there around tax-free savings products? I mean, obviously, you touched on it earlier to say that this was initially meant to be an investment kind of vehicle. It has since taken on what seemingly slightly different wrapper. What are some of the other misconceptions that we need to understand about this product before getting into it or before making use of the product?
Well, I think you touched on one already, which is the fact that you have a lot of flexibility about where you can put that money. And obviously, if you're investing for the long term, most, advisors will tell you, put your money in the market. Long term, that's where you're going to get your most growth. So I think definitely, avoid wasting that tax-free contribution by putting your money into a fixed interest bank deposit. The reality is you're already getting tax exemptions on interest income every year. So it's kind of a double waste. You're getting a tax-free benefit on something that's already got a tax exemption, at least for a big chunk of your initial investment. And then I think there's a big misconception about the saving versus investment idea. I've been horrified to see some of the marketing out there around tax-free savings accounts and them being marketed as something to save for a wedding or save for a deposit on a house. That's terrible advice. The tax-free should be the first thing you put money into that you have available, but it should be the last thing you take it out of. And I think the key there is making sure you also have an emergency fund. I think the one mistake people can make with getting too overzealous with the tax-free is if they have no liquidity. They need to be able to protect that investment by having an emergency fund so they don't withdraw from it too early, because that's where the limits can really damage your long-term planning. Is money you take out of your tax-free doesn't reset your limits. Those limits only measure money going in. So as soon as you start withdrawing from your tax-free savings account, you lose out on any future growth of that money. You can't put it back.
Tax-free savings account, folks. The tax season is upon us, as is the budget season. So make those decisions so that you can maximize on that tax benefit before it's too late. We'll leave the conversation there, Adrian. Thanks so much for those insights and for the time. Adrian Hope Bailey joining us to take a look at tax-free savings accounts.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
That's the show for today, folks. Thanks for tuning in. Remember, this week we will be building up towards the budget speech that will be taking place on Wednesday. On Wednesday itself, once the budget has been delivered, you'll get a 2-for-1 special. We'll do a budget breakdown straight after the budget speech has taken place. And then our evening show will also be dedicated to the budget speech. So lots to look forward to this week. It's going to be a very, very busy week. We've got some of those data points that are also going to be coming out. Unemployment tomorrow and inflation numbers out on Wednesday. So we've got lots to keep you updated on, but it is coming up to 7 o'clock right now. Greg Kos is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.